Chapter 15. Tuesday morning, almost 2 hours were wasted as the lawyers wrangled over some hotly contested motions back in the judges' chambers.
"Probably the photographs," Baggy kept saying. "They always fight over the photographs."
Since we were not privy to their little war, we waited impatiently in the courtroom, holding our seats. I wrote pages of useless notes in a chicken-scratch handwriting that any veteran reporter would admire. The scribbling kept me busy, and it kept my eyes away from the ever-present stares of the Pagets. With the jury out of the room, they turned their attention to the spectators, especially me. The jurors were locked away in the deliberation room, with deputies at the door as if someone might gain something by attacking them. The room was on the second floor with large windows that looked upon the east side of the courthouse lawn. At the bottom of one window was a noisy air conditioning unit that could be heard from any point on the square when it was at full throttle. I thought of Miss Callie and her blood pressure. I knew she was reading the Bible, and maybe this was calming her. I had called Esau early that morning. He was very upset that she had been sequestered and hauled away. Esau was in the back row waiting with the rest of us. When Judge Lupus and the lawyers finally appeared, they looked as though they had all been fistfighting. The judge nodded at the bailiff and the jurors were let in. He welcomed them, thanked them, asked about their accommodations, apologized for the inconvenience, apologized for the delay that morning, then promised that things would move forward. Ernie Gaddis assumed a position behind the podium and began his opening statement to the jury. He had a yellow legal pad, but he didn't look at it. With great efficiency, he rattled off the necessary elements the state would prove against Danny Paget. When all the exhibits were in and all the witnesses were finished, and the lawyers were quiet and the judge had spoken, it would be left to the jury to serve justice. There was no doubt in his mind that they would find Danny Paget guilty of rape and murder. He didn't waste a word, and every word found its mark. He was mercifully brief. His confident tone and concise remarks conveyed the clear message that he had the facts, the case, and he would get his verdict. He did not need long, emotional arguments to convince the jury. Baggy loved to say,
"When lawyers have a weak case, they do a lot more talking."
Oddly, Lucian Wilbanks deferred his opening remarks until the defense put on its case, an option rarely exercised.
"He's up to something,"
Baggy mumbled, as if he and Lucian were thinking together.
"No surprise there."
The first witness for the state was Sheriff Coley himself. Part of his job was testifying in criminal cases, but it was doubtful he'd ever dreamed of doing so against a Paget. In a few months, he would be up for re-election. It was important for him to look good before the voters. With Ernie's meticulous planning and prodding, they walked through the crime. There were large diagrams of the Castlelaw home, the Deese home, the roads around Beech Hill, the exact spot where Danny Paget was arrested. There were photographs of the area. Then there were photographs of Rhoda's corpse, a series of 8x10s that were handed to the jurors and passed around. Their reactions were amazing. Every face was shocked. Some winced. A few mouths flew open. Miss Callie closed her eyes and appeared to pray. Another lady on the jury, Mrs. Barbara Baldwin, gasped at first sight and turned away. Then she looked at Danny Paget as if she could shoot him at point-blank range.
"Oh, my God,"
one of the men mumbled. Another covered his mouth as if he might throw up. The jurors sat in padded swivel chairs that rocked slightly. As the gruesome photos were passed around, not a single chair was still. The pictures were inflammatory, highly prejudicial, yet always admissible. And as they caused a commotion in the jury box, I thought Danny Paget was as good as dead. Judge Lupus allowed only 6 as exhibits. 1 would have sufficed. It was just after 1 p.m., and everyone needed a break. I doubted that the jurors had much of an appetite. The state's second witness was one of Rhoda's sisters from Missouri. Her name was Ginger McClure, and I had talked to her several times after the murder. When she realized I had gone to school at Syracuse and was not a native of Ford County, she had thawed somewhat. She had reluctantly sent me a photo for the obituary. Later, she had called and asked if I could send her copies of the Times when it mentioned Rhoda's case. She expressed frustration in getting details from the district attorney's office. Ginger was a slim redhead, very attractive and well-dressed, and when she settled into the witness chair, she had everyone's attention. According to Baggy, someone from the victim's family always testified. Death became real when the loved ones took the stand and looked at the jurors. Ernie wanted Ginger to be viewed by the jury and arouse their sympathy. He also wanted to remind the jury that the mother of two small children had been taken from them in a premeditated murder. Her testimony was brief. Wisely, Lucian Wilbanks had no questions on cross-examination. When she was excused, she walked to a reserved chair behind the bar, near the seat of Ernie Gaddis, and assumed the position as representative of the family. Her every move was watched until the next witness was called. Then it was back to the gore. A forensic pathologist from the state crime lab was called to discuss the autopsy. Though he had plenty of photos, none were used. None were needed. In layman's terms, her cause of death was obvious, a loss of blood. There was a 4-inch gash beginning just below her left ear and running almost straight down. It was almost 2 inches deep, and in his opinion, and he had seen many knife wounds, it was caused by a rapid and powerful thrust from a blade that was approximately 6 inches long and 1 inch wide. The person using the knife was more than likely right-handed. The gash cut completely through the left jugular vein, and at that point the victim had only a few minutes to live. A second gash was 6.5 inches long, 1 inch deep, and ran from the tip of the chin to the right ear, which it almost sliced in two. This wound by itself probably would not have resulted in death. The pathologist described these wounds as if he were talking about a tick bite. No big deal. Nothing unusual. In his business, he saw this carnage every day and talked about it with juries. But for everyone else in the courtroom, the details were unsettling. At some point during his testimony, every single juror looked at Danny Padgett and silently voted guilty.